I'd like to start out by just giving a few words of introduction. Firstly, I'd like to say a little about my own background, and then a little background to the general seminar itself. As you know, the seminar is about man's origin and evolution, and as you probably know, and will undoubtedly discover, the seminar will be based fairly heavily on information taken from the Secret Doctrine, and indeed the Mahatma letters. My background, as far as it's relevant to this, is that these works, and works similar to them, have been the area in which I've been studying and working now for some 15 years, I guess. I was pitched into this on the very first day that I walked through the door of the Theosophical Society in England. It seems that that was my fate, that it just happened to be a Secret Doctrines group which met on that evening, and Olive Dutter just happened to be there when I walked through the door, and I was had my arm twisted to come and stay, and I've been with it ever since. So there's some synchronicity for you, I suppose, as well. So I mention this because the terminology that I shall use and the book that I'm going to refer to reflect very much the areas in which I've been studying these 15 years. And if some of the terms that I use are not familiar, or perhaps have different connotations for you, then please do say so, and feel free to ask questions about any points that I raise at any time during the seminar. It is my intention to leave time at the end of each of the morning sessions for some questions, so if you have any points, please do make notes of them as we're going along, and when we get to the end, we'll see if we can't cover those points for you. Now, the study that we're about to conduct here is, as I say, very heavily based on the Secret Doctrine, and I would like just to say one or two words about that and about the related method of study that I intend to employ. The Secret Doctrine has, I know, been a daunting subject for many people, perhaps even through their whole theosophical lives, and they have looked at this book and said, yes, no doubt it's fascinating, but it's too difficult for me, and I shall never get round to studying this. I'll leave that to somebody else. Well, it can be a daunting work, and if you start at page 1 and work your way steadily through to page 1400 and whatever, then yes, it will be very difficult. But that, according to Madame Blavatsky, is not the way to study it. She strongly recommends, firstly, that you read the various introductory sections, and then study it by subject matter, rather than just serially reading it page after page. And that is the method that I intend to employ here. I have chosen this theme of man's origin and evolution, and the handouts that you have received in part so far reflect a selection of passages which I have culled from these works and which I will use as the thread to lead us through our studies on this particular subject. The passages I've chosen, I hope, speak for themselves, but I hope to be able to provide the linking material to bring it alive for you, to give you, if I can, some of the insights that it has given to me, and to make it live a little in your minds and hearts. Now, in studying the Secret Doctrine, I think we need to bear in mind two things. Firstly, we are not studying this purely on the basis of the information that it might contain. I noticed in the program, the green program that you have for the Crotona session here, a passage which was comparing the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Well, both knowledge and wisdom are to be found in the Secret Doctrine. There is information in the Secret Doctrine, and information which I believe is very relevant to our world today as it was 100 years ago. But there is also wisdom to be found in it, and in quite a surprising way. I don't know whether you're familiar with it, but there is a little work entitled Madame Blavatsky on How to Study Theosophy. It's a very small pamphlet written by Commander Bowen, and it contains a series of notes that he took of talks with Madame Blavatsky. And one point strikes, a couple of points really, strikes particularly importantly. In one place, she says, come to the secret doctrine not to see what information you can get from it, but to see how far it leads towards the truth. And he said she repeated this with some insistence, to see how far it leads towards the truth. She said in addition to this, and to me this rounds this out, that study of the secret doctrine is, if you will, a method in its own right. The very effort of studying these subjects has an effect on our mind and perception and cognition, which no other comparable study can do. It's not just a question of the information, but the effort that we make in order to comprehend what is being said. For me, this is so self-evident that I wonder whether I need to say it, but I say it anyway. For me, it has come alive in just this way, and for me, the book is self-validating. It builds as you read it, and your perceptions grow one on another, and it's very exciting. And it's some of this vision, excitement, that I'd like to try and get across in the seminar. Now, by way of introduction to this particular study, Man's Origin and His Evolution, I've started with the following premise. We are all familiar with man's sevenfold constitution. This is one of our basic theosophical tenets, the nature of man and his seven principles. But what we perhaps ought to investigate, rather than just taking that as read, taking that at face value, is to ask ourselves, how did this sevenfold constitution of man come into being? Why seven principles, and what is the nature of those principles? How did they come to be the way they are? And this is one of the major questions that we're going to be asking in this seminar, hence man's origins. To do this, we are going to have to look very deeply into man's nature. At times, this is going to get abstract, but I hope not incomprehensible. Now, there is a vast difference between what is abstract and still understandable, and what is abstract and completely meaningless to you. But let's hope I can keep it to the former. Now, I feel we need to set down our roots very deeply in order that we should understand where we now are. It is true that we can acquire a superficial appraisal of our current nature, and perhaps that suffices for many of our needs. But if we want to understand more deeply our nature, then we must plumb those depths of our being to do so. Then also, having understood perhaps a little about our origins and our nature, we want to understand about the processes of evolution. Why do we incarnate in the way that we do? What is the nature of the personality that it should cause us to pass through this seemingly endless sequence of personal reincarnations? This too we can answer, and this too will provide, I hope, insights for you based on information about man's origins. So this is the basis of my inquiry that I have put before you here. And as we go through, I'm going to try and illustrate these themes. Now this brings me to the handouts that you have in front of you. You have so far just the first four pages of this, as Joy indicated. And we will go through more of this as time goes by, but it'll take us a while. I apologize in advance for the quality of the typing, which is entirely my own, and strictly a two-finger effort, and nothing much more, and fairly tedious at that. It gets I'm afraid worse as time goes by. There are more typographical errors later on than there are at the beginning. However, I'm sure you'll bear with me. I'll point out any ones that I remember. What I intend these passages to do is to act as something of the framework around which I'm going to weave my story. I'm reminded of, I think it was Montaigne's idea about, I have culled a posy of other men's flowers, and only the string that binds it is my own. Well, I feel very much the same as far as this is concerned. The flowers here very much are Madame Blavatsky's and her teacher's, the Mahatma's. All I can offer you is the string, which is my selection, my culling, and my interpretation of what these passages mean. I hope the passages speak for themselves. We'll see as we go through. I hope as we proceed with the seminar that you will find time to read the passages that I have provided here, because during the time we have available in the seminar, I don't propose to read every word of every passage, because life is too short and we would never get through anything else. Today I may read some of it because you have only just been given them, but from Wednesday onward it would be nice to feel that you have had a chance to read the relevant passages, and we will keep a little ahead of you as far as the pages are concerned, so that you know where we're going. All right, well, to make a beginning, the way into the subject that I have chosen is indicated in the first passage that you have on page 1. It comes from volume 1 of The Secret Doctrine, and it outlines the way in which man came about in the broadest possible terms. It outlines what we refer to as the three schemes of evolution, the triple evolutionary journey of man. And the passage indicates that with the three numbered points that you see in the middle of the page there. It talks about the Atman, which is the essence of man, his seventh principle, as manifesting through three vehicles or upadis. And these three major vehicles of expression represent the three major components of man's nature, what in Christian terms we would refer to as spirit, soul, and body. Here, as you see, the first is regarded as being the monadic, or spiritual, stream of evolution. This is concerned with phases of our being, which most of us, as yet, hardly touch. We receive the influence of this level of our being within our personal consciousness, but few, if any, of us are capable of living at that level. And yet, this is where we are going. It is this level of our being that we have to bring into full life and function. How are we to do it? Well, as it says, in conjunction with the second stream, which is the intellectual. Intellectual perhaps is a misleading term to use here, because it covers so much, and the term intellect to us is inclined to have only the connotation of our lower mind processes, the everyday logical processes of thought, whereas intellectual here covers far more than that. It covers the whole development of mind, both higher and lower, and, as we shall see, more besides. And the third stream is the physical, and that is concerned with the whole basis of our existence in the physical world. How did this thing, our physical body, and its accompanying inner vehicles, the linga sharira or model body, and the prana, the vital life, how did that complex of three principles come into exactly the form and function that it now has? These are the three major questions which are posited in this particular passage. Now, there are a couple of points in that which I want to draw your attention to. Firstly, each of those three schemes, it is said, is governed by a set of dhyanis. Dhyanis, or spiritual beings, I'm sure you're all familiar with this term, Dhyanis or Dhyan Chohans, are a generic term indicating those beings who have at some past point evolved through a stage analogous to our present human kingdom, have developed self-consciousness, mind, and so forth, and can now exist independently in the inner world without the necessity of a physical vehicle such as we use. They are perfect men minus physical bodies, if you want to put it simply. However, there are, of course, innumerable classes of these, and we will touch on that part of the subject later. But I draw your attention here to the fact that each of these three major schemes that we will be following is governed by, presided over by, one class of Dhyanis, who has a special relationship then to each area of our being. In fact, we could take this one step further, and I could point out that rather than just looking at a broad threefold division, we can in fact consider right down to the level of each principle that the same idea holds true. If you care briefly to have a look at point 11a, there is another glaring typographical error. It wasn't until some while afterwards that I noticed I'd numbered two points 11, which was clever, so I made one of them 11a. In 11a, we have a passage from one of the many commentaries that we find in the Secret Doctrine, passages quoted in italics, and she just says afterwards, from the commentaries, but she doesn't tell us generally which commentaries, or even if she does, it doesn't generally mean much to us. But the passage, as you can see, says, "So with every man and every man in man." The man in inverted commas there, in quotes, means every principle. "So with every principle in man, each," that's each principle, "gets its specific quality from its primary, the planetary spirit." Dhyani, Dhyan Chohan. "Therefore, every man is a septenate, or a combination of principles." Again, notice each having its origin in a quality of that special Dhyani. So, whether we take the broad threefold classification that we started with, or whether we pursue that in detail, standing behind each principle in our constitution, in some way or another that I hope to elucidate, there is one of these classes of beings. Now, the overall emphasis of that first quotation on page one is to me to stress the enormous sense of interdependence of life in cosmos. We say, and we say rightly, that man is the microcosm of the macrocosm. He is the little universe, and is the perfect reflection of the universe as a whole. And this passage begins to indicate how this is so. It is not just a reflection, but it is that literally every part of our being, every way in which we feel, every way in which we think, sense, every faculty that we have reflects the qualities of other beings. It is as if in us is met all these qualities, forces, factors, elements, principles, and man is the perfect conjunction of all of this, and that's what is what makes him the unique being that we currently find. On this earth, that cannot be said, I believe, of any other creature. That is why they use the term divine man, perfect man, and all the symbols in the various religions and so forth speak of the divine man. Well, we are not that divine man yet, but we have within us, care of these Dhyanis, the qualities which would allow us to express all these divine qualities, and ultimately, at the end of our cycle of evolution, we will reflect perfectly all those qualities and become indeed the perfect or divine nim. So the study that we're about to undertake will now concentrate on these three streams of evolution. What I propose to do now is to take up in turn each of these three terms that we've been introduced to, and over the course of the next 2 weeks, pick up and explore the details. For today, and also on Wednesday, we will be concerned with the first of these, which is this monadic stream of evolution. Again, as I said, our roots must go deep. By the time we get round to next week, we will be looking at the intellectual stream, and by that time, you will begin to see, I hope, the immediate relevance of all of this information to how we feel ourselves to be on a day-to-day level. But to make a beginning then, or another beginning. This section then will be concerned with monadic evolution. Now, in order to understand this monadic scheme, first we must enlarge the context to include the whole of humanity, rather than just speaking of ourselves as instances of that stream of evolution. We must widen the perspective and consider the whole of humanity, consider it as one thing, consider it as one kingdom of nature. Now, there is a term which is used in the literature, which to me is evocative of this unitary idea, and in it they refer to a kingdom of nature, man included, as a life wave. Now I think this is a peculiarly graphic symbol. Remember, if you will, that the fabric of cosmos is a living fabric. As Madame Blavatsky was at pains to stress, and is a cardinal tenet of theosophy, there is no dead matter in cosmos anywhere. Now, if we accept that, then everything that we see around us is living. The very minerals themselves, the very air that we breathe, is in some sense living. Therefore, we can perhaps begin to sense that the whole fabric of our existence is in a milieu which is living. Life is the very characteristic of being, of existence. Now, what we are concerned with is evolving life, ultimately with ourselves, that we are an expression of evolving life. Now, the idea of a life wave, to me, pictures a wave moving across the surface of a body of water, a lake, an ocean, a river, makes no difference. It is not the water which moves, but there is motion within that which is the wave that you see moving across. If you were to follow any droplet of water, it just moves up and down. But you see a wave moving across. Now these two simple terms illustrate the difference to me of life and form. Form is the objective aspect, the vehicles of expression that we all use. They are like the drops of water which move up and down. Life, the indwelling consciousness, spirit, mind, self, call it what you will, is like the wave which moves across the surface of the water. We, as a human kingdom, are like that wave. We collectively are a ripple of life moving through an arena, our particular sea or lake, and that is our planetary world. This is the fabric of our being, and in that we express ourselves in a myriad different ways, and collectively as one life impulse moving through it. So when I speak of a kingdom of nature, I mean it in this unitary sense. We are not, ultimately, a collection of disparate individuals, but aspects of this evolving life as an impulse. If we turn our attention to the human monad, as we refer to that term, as we refer to it as Atma Buddhi, This is just an individualized expression of that underlying life wave. There is another term which you will find in the passages I've quoted for this life wave, and that's the term she uses is monadic essence. You'll find that in a couple of the passages. The term is, I guess, graphic enough. The essence of anything is the inner aspect of it, even if it's only vanilla essence. It's all just the inner juice of the thing rather than the outer expression. So your monadic essence, if you like, the true juice of your monad, looked at in that way. It's that which underlies the expression of your individual monad, and that in which you all live and feel and breathe and have your expression. Beautifully expressed the relationship between the individual monad and the underlying essence in another of the commentary-type passages found in the Secret Doctrine, where there is a little dialogue between guru and pupil, Lanu, and the Lanu is asked to comment on the nature of existence and how he sees it, and he replies by saying, of life in general, I guess, and us in particular, I sense one flame, I see countless undetached sparks shining in it. That, I think, sums up the relationship that we're looking at there. He senses one flame because life is one, and the underlying monadic essence animating the human kingdom is indeed one. But I see, with my mind's eye rather than with my spiritual perception, I see countless undetached sparks. Each monad is a spark. The term she sometimes used, scintilla, a spark. But it is an undetached spark, a spark within a flame, a spark as a bright point of consciousness, being, life, within the flame environment that it finds itself a manifestation of. So we shall be looking at this human monad, but I would always like to feel that you keep in mind that it is just an aspect of this monadic essence. A constituent drop, one might say, in the unitary life wave. Now I'd like to pause a moment and just dwell a little on what we mean by this term, monad or spark. Try and tie it down just a little, as we will be using this term throughout this particular session. There are, to my way of thinking, three terms that we can use as the qualities of the monad. And those terms are consciousness, form, and energy. Now, this is a little abstract, I guess, but these to me are the three qualities inherent in that monad, in that unit of being, which it can express. These are its three possibilities. Monad can express consciousness and does so. It underpins consciousness at every level of being. Whether we talk of the spiritual monad, the human monad, the animal monad, whatever you want to call it, it is that unit consciousness manifesting in an appropriate form at whatever level. So consciousness is one of the qualities, one of the ways of expression of that monad. But of itself, consciousness is not enough. Consciousness only becomes an actual consciousness rather than a potential through form, a vehicle, an upadhi. So, although the monad has no form as we would understand it, it has within it the potential of manifesting through form. And as it manifests through form, so wells up within that form a qualified consciousness, a limited, conditioned consciousness. Personal consciousness wells up within the basis of a personal vehicle, a physical body and a personality. And that consciousness that you feel right now is an expression of your indwelling monad. It is not the monad in its entirety, by any manner of means, but it is an expression of it. But these two terms by themselves are not enough. Life is movement. Life is becoming. Life is unfoldment. And therefore the third term that I would associate with monad is energy. You can use whatever term you like as long as it is a dynamic term that you use, because life is process. Life is doing. If we just sat here and did nothing, the life of an oyster would be an exciting life. We must do something, think, feel, anything, to know that we're alive at all. So when I talk of monad then, it is these three terms that I have in mind, and I will try and use these terms again as we go through to show the relevance to our actual existence. Okay, now I want to broaden the spectrum, broaden the basis of the discussion of monadic evolution one stage further by reminding you, as I'm sure you're all familiar, that the human kingdom is but one of seven. Now, this I'm sure is very common ground to us all, and I've just included this for short recap, nothing more, so we won't dwell on it to any extent. You will find that I have included a couple of passages in your handouts, number 2 and 3, which just remind you of the basics of the idea of the seven kingdoms of nature. I want to widen this out because information that I'm going to be talking about later will refer to some of the other of the seven kingdoms as they relate to man. And I want to make sure that you have very clearly in your mind, before we get to those passages, the differences between these various kingdoms. The passage numbered 2 merely points out to you that there are seven kingdoms, that three of them represent elemental stages of life and growth, and then the remaining four are what we're familiar with, the mineral, plant, animal, and human. Now there is just one passage in there, and number 3, which is a similar passage but taken from the Mahatma letters, we find a slightly surprising term. In the second sentence, the Mahatma says, to this, that is to the three objective kingdoms, we add the kingdom of man or the Deva kingdom. Now, Deva in this particular context, the kingdom of the gods, if you like, a godlike kingdom. But that Deva kingdom is man. And where after this, where they refer to perhaps the Deva kingdom, do not be misled into thinking, as perhaps later literature might have indicated to you, that there is some separately constituted Deva kingdom, but that's what they're referring to. In the context of the secret doctrine and the Mahatma letters, if they refer to the Deva kingdom, it is man that they mean. This is just one of these points of terminology which I shall have to point out to you as we go through. This will come up very shortly in another passage that we're about to look at. The second passage also indicates that beings comprising these various kingdoms in their degrees of manifestation are of themselves gradated. And as you see, the terms that they use there are germinal, instinctive, semi-conscious, and fully conscious. And we can apply that specifically to man as he unfolds through his evolutionary journey. He starts as a germinal human being with the potential of a good deal, but manifesting as yet none. And then he moves through the stages indicated, and finally at the apex of his evolution, he will be fully conscious, not as we are at a purely personal level, but ultimately as the Dhyan Chohans are in the spiritual divine world. Okay, so the seven kingdoms then I don't think we need to dwell on. But the reason for raising the question of the seven kingdoms comes in the next area that I'd like to discuss with you, And that is concerning the relative time that it takes for one of these kingdoms to evolve. The first point that I would like to raise is that it takes the full period of seven rounds of planetary evolution to graduate from one kingdom to another. Now, in all that I'm saying, I'm talking about generalities, and I'm talking about the broad rule, and as we shall see as we go through, there are, of course, always exceptions. But before we go to exceptions, it's as well to establish the basic principles. And the first of these is, as that I say, each kingdom graduates into the next higher kingdom after the period of seven rounds of cyclic evolution has been completed. Now, it seems to me that this point is not much emphasized, not much stressed. And as a result of that, people are inclined to have some rather strange notions that their pet animals and so forth are going to graduate into human beings at their next incarnation, and similar ideas to this. Now, this, I believe, is based on sentimentality and so forth. That's understandable. But widening that out and taking away the purely sentimental aspect, we still find the attitude that, yes, it's possible that animals will become human in their next transformation. Now, you will see from what we're saying here that, in fact, if it takes the full period of seven rounds to evolve from animal to man, that this is not going to take place during the cycle that we're currently involved in. Once an animal, in this sense, always an animal. Once a man, always a man. The passages that I've quoted here for you, number 5 and 6, at the bottom of page 1 and top of page 2, merely emphasize this point in two different ways. They weren't specifically intended to make this point, but they make it pretty adequately. I draw your attention firstly to 5, then. The passages which are italicized there are not italicized by me, but by the writers in all cases. I have not added any italics for emphasis purposes, or underline as it is in this particular case. So, in the first sentence, on the descending arc, whence he starts, after the completion of the seventh round of animal life. Well, that in itself is fairly clear. The animal, or whatever animal entity we are concerned with, evolved through seven rounds, just as everybody else does. After that, he starts on his own individual seven rounds. I think that's fairly clear. And in fact, it's amplified on the top of the next page, on point 6, where we see what, in fact, broadly speaking, happens in each of those seven rounds. The information that we're given there says that it's not in the course of natural evolution, natural law, that a man should become a perfect septenary being before the seventh race in the seventh round. Now, the pattern which emerges from this passage is that, in fact, man brings into full function one of his principles in each round. So in the fourth round, the fourth principle, in the fifth round, the fifth principle, and so forth. And that's what you see in the following passage. For it is it says in the next sentence down below, nor is it part of evolutionary law that the fifth principle, manas, mind, should receive its complete development before the fifth round. And there are other passages which say very much the same thing. Now, what we in fact see is that in any one of these rounds or major cycles of evolutionary development, one principle receives full attention, and the others are partially developed at the same time. So here in our fourth round of evolution, our fourth principle is the one which is dominant as far as evolution is concerned. But in all the myriad cycles which make up that fourth round, every aspect of our nature, each of the seven principles, receives attention and is developed proportionately. So being in the fourth round, and therefore being only halfway through our evolution, our principles are only half developed. And this is particularly the case as far as our fifth principle is concerned, as indicated in that passage. At this stage, we have developed what we call lower mind, our everyday mind with its faculties of thinking, remembering, reasoning, and so forth. But there is much, much more to mind than that. And at the very end of this seminar, I shall dwell on those aspects to quite some degree. So, seven rounds then to become graduate from one kingdom to another. Now, perhaps we can just add to that and picture the thing graphically to ourselves, if you like. Again, it's worthwhile trying to bear in mind that the whole process is connected. So we can imagine, if you wish, a giant spiral. I'm not very good at drawing giant spirals, but that'll have to do, I guess. And all that this is intended to indicate is by taking a cross-section at any one time, supposing we take a cross-section through this part of the spiral, these bits here would represent the particular kingdoms of nature as we find them currently. So this bit here would represent the evolving human kingdom, this the evolving animal kingdom, there's the evolving plant kingdom, and so forth. And you'll find it down the bottom here, the minerals. And of course, I've only drawn four out of the overall seven that we could finally look at. But the point to grasp here is that if you follow around the spiral, of course, what is currently mineral, after a vast cycle, will become plant. And what is plant, after a vast cycle, will become animal. But the one line is all that there is. It's all interconnected. Life is one. If you want to think of it in a slightly different way, then you could, of course, think of it as a series of waves across the surface of our pond again, or lake, whatever it is. And here is your human wave, here is your animal wave, your plant wave, your mineral wave, and so forth. These are your life waves or monadic essence. They all move through the same fabric of being. They all move through the same degree of substance. But they are all part and parcel of one thing. There is no difference in between. So what I have done here by taking that is to take a snapshot, is to take a sample at any one particular time. And of course, humans seem very different from animals, animals very different from plants, because we are looking at just a section, a cross-section, through evolving life at any one time. But the whole thing, of course, one process, manifesting in our case as seven interconnected, dependent waves of evolving life. Okay, well, that seems a reasonable point at which to stop.